Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
Hi, I'm Adassa Stein. I'm a fourth-year medical student at SUNY Downstate. I serve on the JOMA Teen Health Committee and am an interviewer for the JOMA Specialty Spotlight Podcast. The Specialty Spotlight Podcasts are geared towards pre-med and medical students interested in learning about different medical specialties. Today, I will be interviewing Dr. Devorah Siegel. Dr. Devorah Siegel was born in Baltimore and grew up in Brooklyn, New York. She graduated from Prospect Park Yeshiva and went to BJJ Seminary, followed by Brooklyn College. She attended Mount Sinai Medical School, where she earned her medical degree and a PhD in neuroscience. She then completed a residency in child neurology at Rutgers, New Jersey Medical School, and a fellowship in pediatric neuro-oncology at NYU. Dr. Siegel practiced general child neurology and neurogenetics at Weill Cornell for several years, where she was also the director of the Child Neurology Residency Training Program. She then returned to NYU, where she practices pediatric neuro-oncology and is the associate director of the Comprehensive Neurofibromatosis Center at NYU and the director of the Pediatric Neuro-Oncology Fellowship. Dr. Siegel is the principal investigator or co-investigator of several clinical trials looking for new treatments for nervous system tumors. She is also the site principal investigator of a clinical trial studying a treatment for metachromatic leukodystrophy. Dr. Siegel lives in Passaic, New Jersey with her husband and five children, all of whom were born while she was in medical school. Dr. Siegel, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
So our first question, why did you choose a career in medicine? And what characteristics make one a good fit for a career in medicine?
So that's usually the first question I get. And my answer is not as straightforward as one would think. My path towards medicine was a little bit roundabout in the sense that from the time that I was 10 or so, I knew I was interested in the brain. I wanted to study the brain. And in fact, in my fourth grade journal, when I was 10, I wrote, this was a journal for school. And one day we had to write what we wanted to be when we grew up. And I wrote, I want to be a neuroscientist when I grew up. So I knew I wanted to study the brain. And as I got to college, I was not actually pre-med. I was a chemistry major and I was taking the GRE. So I was graduate school. And planning to apply to PhD programs in neuroscience, where I could study language acquisition and brain development. And basically, as I went through college, and I was thinking more about the kind of research I wanted to do, mentors who were further ahead than I was, including my uncle, who's an MD PhD, convinced me that if I really wanted to do meaningful human studies research, I needed to do the combined MD PhD degree. So I thought, okay, well, I have all the prerequisites. I'll take the MCAS. I'll see what happens. And basically, as I went through the interview trail and tried to convince everyone who was interviewing me that I really wanted to do an PhD combined degree, I rather convinced myself. So I went to the MD PhD program at Mount Sinai, but I was still really planning on focusing on research because I wanted to understand how the brain works in both health and illness, normal development, and what happens when things go wrong in development. But I did my PhD in a lab, a fantastic lab that was studying autism and schizophrenia. And my project was looking at schizophrenia. And I had a mouse model that I studied, and I had human brain tissue that I studied, and we looked at MRIs of both humans and mice. And it was a fascinating, what we call translational project that bridged more basic science and much more clinically relevant samples, such as the MRIs, et cetera. And it was fascinating. I learned a ton, but by the end of it, I realized that the lab life was not really for me, and that's not what I wanted to do long-term. So I started to think about, well, how can I take my love of science and of neuroscience and find something that I would enjoy clinically or that would make me excited to come to work every day. And when I joined the clinical years, which are the last years, so the MD-PhD is 2 years of medical school, then 3 to 5 years, depending how long it takes in the lab. And for me, that was 4 years. And then the last 2 years of medical school. And as soon as I did my neurology rotation, I realized that I loved, excuse me, and that just the combination of puzzle, problem solving, long-term care of patients where you can follow them for years, acute care of patients who could be quite ill in the moment, and really learning how the brain works and the availability of research questions and research projects was a great combination for me. And then once I did pediatrics, I loved just the combination of pediatrics and neurology was really a slam dunk for me. So I guess why it has a very long-winded answer, but why did I choose a career in medicine? For me, it really started with an interest in science more than an interest in medicine and a desire to learn and understand better about how the human body works and specifically the brain. And once I actually had a chance to learn medicine and practice medicine and treat patients, what drew me to do something more clinical was the joy of being able to help people on a daily basis, as opposed to science where you have to really take the long view. You know, I loved research. I don't want to knock it, but what you do day to day really makes very incremental progress in the field. And it can be hard to see sometimes how what doing the lab translates to how a person actually can be treated and can be healed. Whereas in medicine, every day I can see immediately the effects of how I'm helping people. So what characteristics makes one a good fit for a career in medicine? I think intellectual curiosity is key, because one of the interesting things about medicine is that it's a field in which you're always learning. You can never sit on your laurels and say, I know all there is to know. There's always something new to learn and to find out and to understand. So you have to be a lifelong student. You have to have that curiosity to learn more and know more. Definitely have to be a hard worker. As everyone knows, it's a long slog. It's a long pathway to get to be a doctor. So you have to be someone willing to put in the time and put in the years of effort. And there's a certain dedication and altruism that we need as well, to often put aside our own needs and interests for the interests of our patients. And again, it's as simple as just all those years we need to put in to train, and just the dedication to be there for our patients when they need them. I think that those are necessary traits.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the curiosity is... I think like a huge part of medicine. You always have to be wanting and hungry to learn more for yourself, but also for your patients, like, you know, for research and hopefully making new discoveries and giving new hope for your patients, which you definitely played a huge part in, it seems. And also, yeah. And like also the altruism, as you were saying, that's the perfect combination.
Thank you. Yeah, I really do think that I try to emphasize this to my residents and medical students, that being a lifelong learner is such a key part of medicine, and it attracts people who love to be constantly challenged. You can't, if you're practicing medicine the same way you were when you graduated medical school, you're not going to be a good doctor. And to me, that I think that can be daunting for some people and a little scary. But to me, that's one of the things that makes medicine so exciting and interesting, that it's really not the same, and you are always being challenged and faced with things you don't know and opportunities to learn something new.
Can you walk us through a typical day for you as a pediatric neuro-oncologist and tell us why you decided to go into this specialty?
Sure. So that's, again, I have a more complex answer to that, but I'm going to start with the second part first. So talking about why I decided to go into this specialty. So I already mentioned that neuroscience and neurology was sort of a given for me from a very early age. And then when I did my pediatrics clerkship, I was not expecting to enjoy working with kids. I had 4 kids of my own by that point, and I used to joke that I love working with my own kids. I don't want to deal with anyone else's. But I found when I did pediatrics that I loved the joy that you have working with kids, which is different sometimes than what you get with adult medicine. I'd love the idea, the opportunity to be creative. So in the neurologic exam, for example, it's very structured when you do the neurologic exam on adults. And every piece of the exam is designed to bring out and examine a different part of the nervous system. But when it comes to kids, you have to be more creative because you can't really tell a two-year-old exactly how to follow your exam to get the information you need. So instead of doing something called finger to nose, where in adults we say, touch your nose, touch my finger, touch your nose, touch my finger, and that tests coordination. In a two-year-old, I might say, give me a high five. Now one over here. Now how about over here? And we're sort of dancing around the room doing the exam. So there's a lot of joy and fun and creativity in it. And the other thing is that kids are in a way simpler than adults, and that they usually have one problem. And if you can treat and heal that problem, you can make them better. Whereas with adults, their medical problems are so often complicated by other things. You know, they might be there for a stroke, but they also have high blood pressure and high cholesterol, et cetera. So I think to me, pediatric neurology was almost more of a pure neuroscience and neurology than adult medicine. And just like I said before, the joy of working with kids. I'm an educator. I taught high school for a few years while I was in college, and I've continued to teach medical students and residents. And in pediatrics, you're treating the child, but you're also educating the family how to understand their child's illness, how to best manage their child's illness. And I really enjoyed that part as well, the education of parents and the patients. Now, pediatric neuro-oncology is a tiny, tiny subspecialty, and it's a good question as to why I wound up there. Especially since I didn't particularly enjoy my oncology oncology rotations as a peds resident. And the reasons are, there are a few of them. Number one, as I said before, I like taking care of patients longitudinally. So not just seeing them in the ER, for example, when they're at their sickest, but taking care of them over time and getting that long-term follow-up and really getting to know patients and their families. That's one of the joys in medicine. And number two, I also enjoy taking care of patients who are quite sick. So you get that combination of acute illness and also long-term follow-up in neuro-oncology. Number three, I like neurogenetics, and that's one of the things that I sort of built into my practice in my previous position and continue here. And neuro-oncology includes a lot of neurogenetics. So one of my specialties now is neurofibromatosis, which is a genetic syndrome that predisposes people towards the development of certain tumors. So it's a combination of genetics and neuro-oncology. I forget which number I'm up to, number four maybe. Neuro-oncology is very much a team specialty in that I might be the oncologist, but I'm also interfacing with the surgeons, and I communicate with the radiologists, and I get information from the pathologists. I work with a nurse practitioner, with coordinators, with social workers, and every patient who comes in has a team of specialists who are helping them and working with them. And we have team meetings. We have tumor board every week where we go through difficult patients and new MRIs and decide what to do. So I'm not operating in a silo. I get to work as part of a team, which I really enjoy. And then lastly, there are more reasons too, but the last reason I'll talk about today is that there are so many opportunities for research. So even though I decided at the end of my PhD that lab work and lab bench work research was no longer for me, I still very much wanted to be involved in research. And in neuro-oncology, there's so much to learn and so much to know, so many opportunities for research, both basic and clinical trials and clinical research, that really drew me to the field. So it's a perfect combination for me of that research opportunities, that intellectual curiosity, long-term care of patients, acute care of sick patients, education, neurogenetics. It's really a combination of all the things I love. So I couldn't imagine a field better suited to me.
That sounds really fascinating. you got like everything, the long-term cure with the patient, and you also get to interact with your different colleagues from different specialties and the research component. So
yeah, it's really great. I mean, I love what I do. I can't imagine myself doing anything else. And that brings me to the first part of your question, which I'll answer second, which is walking you through a typical day as a pediatric neuro-oncologist. So most of pediatric neuro-oncology is actually outpatient. There's not a ton of inpatient medicine. I do a few weeks a year of inpatient service for neurology. I cover the neuro-oncology inpatient about half the time. I split it with one or two of my other colleagues, but that's more just sort of getting my opinion for emergencies. It's not a lot of inpatient responsibility. So mostly I'm seeing patients in the outpatient setting, and that can range from someone who's 30 years out from treatment for a medulloblastoma and is coming for their annual checkup and MRI, to someone who's being actively treated on chemotherapy and coming in every few weeks for treatment. So there's the combination of, like I said before, very acutely ill and newly diagnosed kids and very long-term follow-up, which I love. I also, as part of the neurofibromatosis center, we follow patients of all ages with NF1, NF2, and schwannomatosis, which are three different but interrelated neurogenetic disorders. And I see patients from newborns to any age. So far, the oldest I've seen is 86, which seems a little odd for a pediatric neuro-oncologist, but it's part of my care of patients with this genetic disease, which is also fun. I see whole families come in sometimes. We can follow people over the long term. And it's really an incredible opportunity to take care of patients and families for years and decades even. My clinical trials are mostly built into my practice, meaning I don't, except for one rare exception, I don't have separate time set aside for clinical trials. These are my patients. So they're coming to see me for tumor X. And as part of their treatment, I enroll them on a clinical trial. And that involves usually very structured visits with lab work and a specific exam and getting their medication, recording data, and then submitting everything to the sponsors of the clinical trial.
The next question is, pediatric neuro-oncology sounds like it can be emotionally taxing. What is your experience balancing empathy for patients with avoiding burnout?
So that's a really important question, and one of the other first questions that people ask me when they find out my specialty after, why on earth are you doing this? So I just want to dispel some misconceptions, which is that pediatric neuro-oncology is such a sad field and it's terrible and your patients all die. So of course there are tragedies that happen and unfortunately we lose patients, and each one is difficult to really, it's a difficult experience. But overall, actually, the survival rate of pediatric brain tumors is over 85% at this point. So it's not nearly as doom and gloom and as people think it is. That varies very widely with tumor type, of course. So some tumor types have very, very poor survival rates and others have nearly 100% survival rates. But overall, 85% survival is really pretty good. And that's come very far in the decades since the field was founded in the early 80s. However, that said, we're dealing with kids who are very sick and real challenges that they and their families are facing. And it can be quite emotionally taxing. So I think there are a few things that are important. One is to carve out time for self-care. And that's not just in this field, that's in any field of medicine. To find something that you enjoy doing and make sure you have that time to do it, whether it's once a day, once a week, but, and it can be anything. It can be exercise, it can be reading, it can be watching a series you enjoy, it can be spending time with family, cooking, anything that you do just for you. And like I said, that's important, I think, for anybody in medicine, not just, and even more so for a field like pediatric neuro-oncology. And number two is to try to set some sort of boundary between work and home, which can be hard because so many people who go into medicine are dedicated and altruistic, as we talked about before. But it's really important to recognize that if you don't have some kind of boundary, you're not going to be your best self at work. And I think there are times when I tell my students, do as I say, not as I do. I'm not always great at following my own advice. But one thing I do for myself is that once I get home, I almost never check my work email. So of course, I'm still on call sometimes, and sometimes I get phone calls or texts that I have to address, but I really try to at least not check my work email when I'm not at work. Sunday night, I'll usually check it really quickly just so I know what I'm coming into Monday morning, but at least I know that there's a separation, and anything that's an email is not urgent and can wait until the next morning. And then a third thing is to take advantage of your colleagues and find joy in talking to your colleagues, in commiserating — that's not really the best word, but really just sort of leaning on each other, because we're all going through the same things. And in oncology especially, they're pretty good at finding ways to make that happen. So for example, whenever we lose a patient in the pediatric cancer clinic, they have a debrief session where everyone can get together and talk about their experiences, talk about the patients. And we have that opportunity to really lean on each other, rely on each other, and help each other through the difficult times. And I think it's important to know that your colleagues are there for you. And sometimes they're the only ones who really understand when you've had a difficult day and have gone through something hard. I think leaning on them, finding space for yourself, and then what I mentioned before, finding the joy in work. Even in a hard day and in a hard situation, there are joyful things. So losing a patient is devastating and probably one of the worst things any doctor can experience. But remembering the times that you were there for the family, being there for the parents when they have questions, and in their worst times and their most difficult times, can be very rewarding, even if the outcome is not what we hoped.
Yeah. I had a teacher in college that had said to me that once — it was a medical ethics class — and she said that medicine is about standing with your patient in the face of fear.
And I love that.
Yeah. That really had spoke to me. And it seems like, you know, that's what you're doing with these patients in these really critical times.
And yeah, I think so. Sorry, go ahead.
No, what were you going to say?
I think that's right. I really love that, standing with them in the time of fear. And then another, the PICU attending who I worked with when I was a resident, and in the PICU, you can have really some of the sickest patients and the most dismal outcomes. So I asked him how he manages. I think we had just had a patient die. And he said he sees his job — of course, he's taking care of the patient medically, but he sees his responsibility to the families as making sure that if these are the last memories they have of their child, that there's some joy and hope in them, even if the outcome isn't as good as it can, as we hoped, or as a terrible outcomes, of course, when a child dies, but making sure they have some good memories of that time as well. Some mm-hmm. positive experience that they've shared with their child, and positive interactions with the medical staff. I think that's really important too.
Yeah.
And the opportunity to just treat people with kindness and give that kindness, I think, is key.
Yeah. I think that patients want that. They want empathy and, you know, as people. And mm-hmm. also, like you were saying, that in order to, I think, give that kindness, you need to be kind to yourself, which was like you were saying with the self-care, so you can be that best doctor for your patients.
Yeah, and it's easier said than done sometimes. We, as doctors, tend to be a very, a group of people who puts ourselves last. And I think the medical field in general is recognizing that's not sustainable. And we're recognizing how important it is to think about physician wellness as well. And that's a positive move in the field.
Yeah. I had, after the codes that we have in the hospitals that I've rotated through, there's always a debriefing session.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was wonderful. The first time that I saw that, and it's like, how, you know, obviously we've all just gone through a really emotional experience together, and debriefing with our colleagues, how do we feel about this, was really, really powerful for me.
Yeah, and that's so essential from an emotional perspective and a practical perspective, because when things don't have the outcome you want, we sometimes look at well, what could I have done differently? What went wrong? What should I have done that I didn't do? And sometimes talking things through and recognizing that there aren't always things we can do. There are many things that are out of our control is important. Or if there are things that we can do better, taking it as a learning experience and saying, okay, well, next time I will give harder compressions, or I will be more attuned to what my team leader is saying, or whatever it is. So you can take it as a learning experience for the next time, can be a powerful opportunity and make something positive out of a negative experience, or what could have been a negative experience.
Next question. As director of the Child Neurology Residency Program, what are some qualities you look for in an applicant?
So some of the most important qualities are the qualities that I mentioned earlier on that make one fit for a career in medicine. So that intellectual curiosity is key in pediatric neurology and neuro-oncology. It's a sort of an intellectual field. We very much value research. So as opposed to some other fields, research experience is very important. And more than the actual research and whether you have publications, it's just the sense that you have that scientific curiosity, that intellectual curiosity, and are a lifelong learner. That's what it's an indication of. By the time people get to an interview, they've passed the first few hurdles, which are, did you pass your STEP scores? Did you do well in your clinical clerkships? Did you get good letters of recommendation? Letters of recommendation are very important because it can be so hard to figure out what the grades mean in different schools, you know. So someone who got all honors who came from school A, it might be very different from someone who got high pass and came from school B. And it's hard to really standardize that information. So letters of recommendation are important. And I always tell my students and my residents who are applying for fellowships or residencies, you're better off getting a letter of recommendation from someone low on the totem pole who knows you well, than from someone with a big name who's going to write a very generic letter, because we really want to get a sense of who you are as a person. And that brings me to the most important thing I look for when I interview candidates, which is this someone I would want to work with for the next 3+ years? Because in the end of the day, you spend so much time with your residents and coworkers, sometimes more than you spend with your family. And if it's someone who is just unpleasant to work with, inflexible, angry, mean, that's not someone who I would want as part of my program. So we're looking for people at the baseline is you have to be academic, you have to be intellectually curious, you have to be a decent person. But then I look for those sort of difficult to define traits that tell me that you're someone who is flexible, who will help out a colleague who needs help, who will have a positive attitude when they come into work, and will be fun and nice to spend time with over the next few years.
I'm in the application process now, so for me to hear these things too.
Good luck. Yeah. So I think there's, even in the med school arena, there's much more of an emphasis now on what kind of a person are you, and not just what kind of scores did you get. So you have to get good grades and good MCAT scores just to get your foot in the door. But the interview process, from what I understand, and I don't interview for med school, so I don't know necessarily firsthand, but I know they're doing more like behavioral interviews where it's more sitting in a room and talking about, well, how would you respond to situation A and situation B? And what they're really trying to do is get a sense of who you are as a person. You know, there are plenty of people out there who can do great on standardized tests and get all, all A's, but are not people you would want as your doctor because of their, just who they are as a person and their moral compass and lack of empathy or whatever. So I do think that that's a positive move from med schools, where it's not just all about your MCAT score.
Yeah. And some of them are blinded applications, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That they won't even look at your scores before and
really
base it off of that.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
Wow. So next question. Can you tell us more about the clinical trials you are currently involved in?
Sure. And I can get very passionate about this, so I hope I don't chew your ear off. Clinical trials are really, in oncology, they're sort of the bedrock of what we do, because so much so much has changed in oncology and neuro-oncology in the last couple of decades. And I think 20 years from now, we'll be looking back and saying, I can't believe we used to do that. I can't believe we used to use those toxic medications. I think we'll have even better options as time progresses. And then there are lots of tumors and disorders that don't have any treatment, at least no established treatment yet. So clinical trials are the only way we have, experimental treatments to treat these kids. So I'm involved in a lot of clinical trials. One is not oncology at all. It's for a disorder called metachromatic leukodystrophy, which is an autosomal recessive genetic disorder that causes breakdown in the white matter of the brain and cranial nerves and other long nerves. So children with metachromatic leukodystrophy or MLD are born looking normal and usually have typical development until sometime between about a year and 18 months, and then start losing skills and regressing. And you can see on MRI that the white matter of their brain is just slowly being destroyed. If they're missing a certain enzyme, and what this clinical trial does is it injects an artificial version of that enzyme back into the CSF space. So they have a special port placed, and we inject a version, an artificially made enzyme, into the CSF in the hopes that it will act in place of the enzyme they're missing and help prevent further decline or even repair the white matter. So that's one of the clinical trials. And then I have a number of oncology clinical trials I'm involved with, which are looking at different combinations of chemotherapy or targeted therapies for specific brain tumors. So we are now in what we call the molecular era or the molecular genetic era, where instead of just treating tumors with a machine gun, where you classic chemotherapy, where you just kill every cell that's dividing, we try to look for, well, what is the genetic mutation that's driving tumor growth, right? So we know that healthy cells have all kinds of checks and balances to ensure that they divide and grow normally, but don't get out of control. And that can be controlled by genes that turn on cell destruction if they see that cells are dividing too fast, or mechanisms of activating the immune system to destroy cells that are abnormal and are growing too quickly and becoming a tumor. And when those mechanisms go awry, that's when tumors and cancers can form. So for the last, I guess, at least 10 years, probably about 10 years now, what the field has been doing is, well, let's try to study these tumors and find the mutations that have turned off those protective mechanisms. And let's try to develop medications that can overcome that mutation. So for example, there are medications called MEK inhibitors that target an enzyme called MEK, and I forget offhand what the ME stands for, but the K is a kinase. So it's an enzyme that triggers an overgrowth pathway. And if you can block that enzyme, you block that growth pathway and stop the tumor from growing. Or there are medications called mTOR inhibitors, which similarly can block molecular pathways that trigger tumor growth or pathways that turn off the immune system. So there are immune checkpoint inhibitors, which basically turn off the mechanisms that turned off the immune system. So it reactivates the immune system and allows it to attack tumors before they grow or to shrink tumors that are growing. So there are a number of clinical trials targeting very specific mutations for specific cancers and tumors that I'm involved in. And it's really exciting to be on the cutting edge, where a tumor where we previously had no treatment or just had very broad treatment that would cause so many side effects because it was that machine gun. And now we can take, instead of a machine gun, we're using a sniper rifle. Sorry to use these very violent analogies, but we're trying to take out the very precise mutation that's causing tumor growth rather than a very broad effect, and in the hopes that A is more effective for tumor control and B causes fewer side effects, both in the short term and the long term.
Thank you for that. In my first year, we have a dedicated week for specifically talking about cancer and mechanisms of replication. And they go through the whole pathway of all the different things that can get like upregulated or not no longer under control. And I found it so fascinating how they have different drugs that they've developed to target every single part of that pathway. And
yeah,
How it takes the, I guess, you know, the basic science and it turns it into what you're talking about before, the translational research. I think it was really, really fascinating. Fun week.
Yeah, I mean, it's so, so interesting. And there's so many avenues for research. It's really an exciting field.
So the next question, if you could go back in time, given the experience and perspective you have now, is there anything you'd want to have done differently?
I think from a professional perspective, I don't think so. I think I did not wind up where I thought I would. I thought I'd be doing basic science research in a lab somewhere, but I wouldn't trade what I do now for anything. So I certainly wouldn't change that. And I think even though my path was kind of winding, it was the path I needed to go on to wind up where I am now. And even though I'm not doing lab work, my PhD, I use the skills I learned there. I use them every day in the work I do. So I certainly wouldn't change anything from that perspective. I think the one thing I would change that I can think of offhand is to be more accepting of help. So as you mentioned in my bio, my five kids were all born while I was in medical school, including a set of twins who are now 15. So time really does go by fast. And I was very, like so many of us, I was very type A and kind of, I'm going to do everything on my own. And I didn't accept as much help as I should have from family members, from friends. And I think being open to accepting help is one of the biggest pieces of advice I can give really to any medical student, but or resident, but especially to one who's trying to balance other obligations, whether their work or family or anything, is being open to accepting help from the people who care about you and not thinking that you have to be tough enough to do everything on your own.
That's incredible that the five kids.
thank you.
That's pretty amazing.
It was a busy time, that's for sure, but we got here.
So the last question, what advice do you have for pre-med students interested in pursuing an MD PhD?
So I would say, which I say for medicine in general, but MD PhD even more so, is really make sure this is what you want to do. It's a long haul. One of the nice things about the MD PhD is that if you're in an MSTP program, which is the NIH funded program, they pay for your medical school, which is wonderful. You come out with no debt, which is great, but it's 3 to 5 extra years of your life. For most people, about 4 extra years to do a PhD. And that's a big commitment. So make sure this is really what you want to do. And if you can see yourself happy doing something else, strongly consider that other thing. But if this is where you see yourself and you can't see yourself doing anything else, then I say go for it. And my father told me when I was applying to programs, MD PhD programs, I said, it's 7 years. 7 years is such a long time. And he said, 7 years from now, you're going to be 7 years older, no matter what you do. And don't you want to look back on those 7 years and say, I did what I dreamed of. I followed my goals and my aspirations and I achieved my goals. So I think don't be daunted by the time it takes. If this is really what you love, it's going to be worth it in the end, but make sure it's really what you want to do. And then from a practical experience is get as much research as you can as an undergrad with publications, if at all possible, because the research experience is the most important thing on your application for MD PhD applicants. More MCAT scores are important, of course, but the research is more important. So really, whatever it takes, while you're an undergrad, find a lab that you can join. There are summer undergraduate research programs or research fellowships called SERP or SERF that most medical schools have, where you can apply as an undergrad. And it's a very structured program where they pair you with a mentor and they put you in a lab and they give you presentation opportunities. So definitely do that, those if you can, and really get a sense of how labs work, to make sure it's something you like, and to have that research to put on your resume, because that's the number one most important thing that MD PhD programs look at. You still do have to try to get some of the other experiences that pre-med students get. So if you can, some shadowing or volunteer experience to get the clinical experience. but prioritize the research, because that's going to be the most important thing that they look at.
But yeah, I have to say about the time, my mom actually said the same thing to me. I was kind of debating this also. This is the path I want to take. And ultimately, I realized that this is really what I want to do with my life. And, you know, the time goes by either way. And
yeah,
if, you know, you want to look back and be proud of yourself.
So, yeah, I agree 100%. And every time I have a birthday, I had a birthday over the summer, and everyone was joking, oh, you're 27 again. You know, this people tried to downplay their age. And I said, no, I'm really proud of my age, because I look back at the years and I feel like I've done something with it. So I have nothing to be ashamed of for being how old I am. And I'm proud to claim it and to own it. So yes, those years go by no matter what. And I think if there's something you really, that is going to make you fulfilled and make you happy, and you see it as your purpose, then go for it. And don't let the time scare you.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Siegel.
You're very welcome. I just want to add one last thing, because I mentioned about kindness and I was trying to remember where I'd read it. And I read an obituary this weekend for someone. He's a neurologist, an adult neurologist named Dr. Ted Burns. I don't know him. I never met him. I never even heard of him. He was a neurologist at UVA and died recently of cancer. But apparently he had a podcast and he wrote an article about being a patient, being who's also a doctor. And he said, I'm going to read from his quote from something he wrote, his essay, if you don't mind, it's called On Being Sick. And he wrote, "One tends to get a little philosophical during chemotherapy, and I'm doing that now. I have tried to teach my residents and fellows that one of the most important things they can do with every encounter is to convey kindness. Their concern, intelligence, acumen, professionalism, and intellectual curiosity need to back this up to complete their role, of course. But if they don't convey kindness, it is not likely the patient-doctor relationship can meet its potential, if it goes anywhere at all." I thought that was so beautiful. You know, the basic bedrock of being a doctor is you have to have that clinical acumen, that intellect, but it's the kindness that we have the opportunity to exercise and practice with every patient encounter that really makes us the doctors who we are, and not just a machine or a computer who's running through lists of diagnoses.
Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. That was very beautiful.
Yeah, thank you.
I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Same here. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
To everyone else in your position and in this field. And I think that be brave, do what you dream, and you will be wonderful at it.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.